Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your co-host, Paul David.
And I'm your co-host, Maya Darren-Paul-Hornby.
Today, we're joined by Ben Dodson, who's the co-founder and CEO of Dowii. That's D-O-O-W-I-I. And we're going to talk about transforming data for educators with AI. This is something near and dear to my heart. Ben, I don't know if you know, but I'm a former teacher and educator for about a decade in the States. But yeah, welcome to the pod, Ben.
Oh, awesome. What did you teach?
I taught English and history in eighth grade in Philadelphia. And then I worked in a bunch of different school districts, New York, a couple school districts in California. I taught in a prison at some point. So yeah.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. Well, thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
So just by way of introduction, Ben, you run Dowii, which is a generative AI platform that has been built specifically for educators, and would have loved to have it when I was in the classroom.
So it puts educational insights from attendance, grades, and feedback all at the fingertips of its users.
Ben co-founded Dowii after working in data science for an impressive roster of tech companies, just small ones like Google, Snapchat. You eventually wanted to pursue your own project. You co-founded Dowii last year, and last month closed your latest fundraising round, having secured $4.1 million. Congrats, Ben. That's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
And was that a seed round, Series A, seed?
Yeah, it was. We had kind of a first close on that round a little kind of late last year, and continue to essentially roll on saves or stack saves on top until we called it around April, May of this year. And so that was essentially kind of like a seed plus, so probably a larger seed than we had anticipated initially, but yeah, you know, in this environment it was not bad to kind of raise a little extra to just give us more runway to be able to execute at this stage.
I was gonna say, yeah, in this environment, like, yeah, that's a really solid seed round, so kudos for that. And and just for our audience, explain what a SAFE is, just because I think folks might not know.
Sure. So SAFE stands for a simple agreement of future equity, and basically just allows investors to come in without having to price the company, which is very difficult at our stage, but instead they can essentially invest money at either conversion discount or what's called a valuation cap, which is what we did. And essentially they can say, okay, you know, when in a future price round, we'll be able to get, you know, this price. You know, generally it's a pretty good price compared to what you would anticipate for us to raise that future price round in our A round, for example. So it's just a lot less paperwork than doing a price round, essentially, and, you know, allows investors and founders to be able to move quicker. And it was introduced by YC, you know, kind of famously about 15 years ago or so, and has pretty much become de facto standard.
And YC is Y Combinator for those listening.
Yes, yeah, right, Y Combinator.
Right. Yeah, all good, all good. Well, thanks for that little bit of investment education to kick us off, Ben. Really appreciate it. Our audience is more well-informed about the investment ecosystem as a result.
And yeah, while you're still in sort of education mode, I was wondering if you could just explain to our listeners exactly what Dowii does.
Yeah, absolutely. So the genesis of Dowii came from the idea of there's a lot of data science improvements, you know, progress that's been made over the past several decades, right? And during my career in big tech, I continually saw this progress as far as things just getting more accurate, faster, better across the landscape of being able to do predictive analytics, being able to do all sorts of different things. However, at the end of the day, you still have to pay, you know, a data scientist hundreds of thousands of dollars, no matter if they're writing 1,000 lines of code or like 100 lines of code, you know. Even, and so the theory was, even though that there's a lot of progress being made in data science, it wasn't necessarily translating over well for educators. And so with Gen AI, could we essentially create an AI data scientist that pulls together a lot of different components of data science, and being able to write kind of 100 lines of code here, 100 lines of code there, to emulate that ability for a data scientist to, you know, query, analyze, visualize data, run predictive models, and give that as kind of like a personalized data scientist for every educator. So they don't have to invest, you know, the districts and universities don't have to invest millions of dollars in a modern data stack, data architecture, data team, but instead could have access to that at a fraction of the cost.
Fascinating. Thank you. As we've sort of covered, you securing $4.1 million in that seed funding does demonstrate the market's appetite for sort of ed tech right now. Would you be able to tell our listeners about when Gen AI first became used in education and what data gathered can offer to educators?
So Gen AI is definitely relatively new to education. I would say it became widely popular and to a certain degree, I think it's widely popular, at least widely known, like along with many other industries during the launch of ChatGPT, essentially, right? Prior to that, I would say very little Gen AI was being taken place, or it wasn't really being recognized or called Gen AI. It was maybe like a feature, for example, in terms of like generating some things on the back end for certain companies, but no one was really adopting, let's say, a Gen AI strategy, right? Or recognizing a Gen AI strategy, whereas now that's really just being actively discussed on tips of every tongue in terms of across districts and universities and how to apply that. As far as how that data is being used, it really depends. I mean, it's such a diverse landscape in terms of both where different districts are in terms of their attitude to adoption of AI, what they consider is AI, because even I think most districts don't necessarily distinguish between what's AI versus Gen AI. And also the applications of that, right? And so I think a lot of that is still, as far as adoption goes, a lot of it is being figured out for some of these tools that, such as ours, that do require a heavier integration process. For other tools like ChatGPT, for example, or teacher tools that a teacher can just like sign up for, let's say, those are seeing a lot faster adoption rather than waiting on kind of district to make a decision, right? Or the administration to make a decision on how to move forward. But it's kind of like the teacher can just say, okay, I can just start signing up for ChatGPT right now and make my life easier, essentially. And a lot of them are will pay out of pocket for that, right? Not necessarily rely on the district to buy something. And so that's kind of how it is at the moment.
Yeah, and just to set the scene too, I mean, some of this like drive for, you know, implementing generative AI in education is being driven by like real progress gains that we're seeing here. So there was a report from EdTechX that showed that, you know, classrooms using AI-driven interactive tools saw like a 20% increase in student participation and a 15% increase in knowledge retention rates. And another study from McKinsey looked at AI in education, including generative AI, and showed that it reduced administrative workloads by about 30%, which allowed educators to focus more on teaching and student interaction. Would have loved that when I was in the classroom. There was so much grading and admin and stuff like that I had to do that pulled me away from students and their learning. So it's really exciting to see these early gains. And obviously, you know, you're taking that a bit further with Dewey. So yeah, appreciate the work they all are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And to be honest, though, like hearing those statistics, I would just be kind of skeptical of them, because I'm sure, like, in, you know, your background as a teacher, you know, like the problems that you have in Philly or New York is like very different than the problems that like a 1,000 student district in Iowa or Texas has necessarily, right? It's like, it's not the same, like not every single district in US is necessarily worrying about the same thing or being run in similar ways. And so even the adoption of like the same tool, whether it's in like New York versus Florida or Texas, can look quite different. And so I'm not sure how EdTechX is getting those statistics. Like, how are they actually monitoring something like student participation, right? What's the sample size there, anything like that? And also I would say like those studies likely are measuring short-term gains. So like what's actually long-term impact, for example, right? Are you seeing more of a novelty effect from introducing an AI tool into a classroom as far as participation? Does that actually last over the long term? So like, I think there's definitely indication that AI has a lot of potential, but some of those reports, I feel like it's better to be more skeptical right now, given the kind of early stage of adoption.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, it'd be good to follow up with EdTechX on that. But sort of, I think you're like framing really nicely how fraught this moment is for, you know, Gen AI in general, but also AI implementation in education. There's a, you know, Stanford study that showed that 80% of educators, you know, acknowledge benefits of AI, but also 70% of them were concerned about potential biases in AI-generated content. You've spoken about the flaws of AI content detectors gaining widespread use in schools. Would love to hear about your reservations on that specifically, because I know that's like a hot topic in AI right now.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, I think I wouldn't trust any of the AI detectors as far as their accuracy goes, right? Because partly it's, I don't necessarily trust lot of the statistics they have, and what they claim in terms of their accuracy. I've read their papers, for example, and they will test, several different cohorts, several different types of testing methodologies, and they will pull out the testing cohort that gives them the highest metric necessarily, right? And pretend like that kind of applies broadly. But your ability, for example, to test like English written essays let's say like the university level, right? Like you might have 1% accuracy, or you may have a certain percentage of accuracy for that. But if you introduce a subpopulation of like English as a second learners, for example, that accuracy tends to drop considerably, because English as a second learner, like the way they write English is more atypical, let's say, right? And so it's harder to kind of detect whether that's AI written or not AI written, for example. And it could be a lot of different types of like breakdowns, essentially. And so generally, the percent accuracy of any of those AI detector tools really varies by domain, whether that's subject or by student population. But also it's constantly changing, right? Like the models that students are using is often essentially the latest model that OpenAI or Anthropic is releasing. And so if you're an AI testing company saying like, oh yeah, we tested on GPT 3.5 and we had 99% accuracy, right, for that, like that metric is pretty much entirely irrelevant at this point. And so if you just want to think of like fundamentally how AI detectors work, right, they are themselves often a type of transformer model or some machine learning model, right, that is trying to extract signal from a body of text. And so if there is signal that exists within that body of text to differentiate between human and AI, well, that signal can also be used by OpenAI or by Anthropic or whoever else to improve the quality of writing, because they're not necessarily thinking in terms of cheating, not cheating. They're just thinking in terms of, can I make this text sound more human, right? More genuine often.
And less detectable, right? So like eventually those models will catch up with the detectors and render the detector somewhat.
Exactly. If there's a signal in there to detect, there's also a signal there to train and improve.
Yeah, right. Like to evade detection. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you're talking in terms of like a constant arms race. And like on one side, you have OpenAI with like billions of dollars in funding. Yeah. And on the other side, you have these like specialized AI ed tech AI detectors that are with, far fewer resources, essentially, right? And so it's like, who's winning that arms race? And then I think there's just like the overall moral issue of saying to a student, hey, our AI detector thinks that you're cheating. What about your false positive rate there? So as far as like what really matters here is not just like your overall accuracy, right? But like, what is your precision? Because you can be able to detect half of like the cheaters pretty accurately if, let's say, it comes at the expense of 20% of the time you have a false positive. And that's to me, like, no one's really said, well, what's the acceptable rate there, right? Do you basically say, like 20% of the time we're going to falsely accuse someone and there's nothing they're going to be able to do about it just because we want to be able to take action on, the 80% that are cheating, essentially. And to me, that's like very fundamentally unfair. And so I think, I haven't really seen that being addressed or discussed about in terms of university administrative policies or how people are applying these AI detectors as well. And so, yeah, just generally, I think it's a bad idea. To give you a sense of the unreliability too of these systems, like OpenAI had an AI detector that they removed because they were just like, this is not going to be reliable enough for us to continue, essentially. And another API, kind of AI API company called Hive.ai, they also had an AI detector and that they kind of shut down after a few months as well. And for what I assume is similar reasons, they didn't say anything about it, but I just noticed that like they had it up and then now it's not available anymore.
Do you see things moving just to a point where these AI tools that students are using to, arguably support their learning, depending on how where you stand, become just like, kids using Microsoft Word to write up essays. Like, you know, I'm sure there was friction when Microsoft Word came out of like, oh, no, you should write it by hand. And then some kids were like, no, I can use Microsoft Word, use this spell checker. I can do it a lot faster. And then eventually just became accepted practice. Do you think we'll see that, like just these tools becoming accepted practice in, you know, I don't know, 3, 5, 10 years? Like, what would you see coming down the pike there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of analogies you can draw to other technological shifts, technological innovations that has shifted the way that we think about a certain medium, right? And so whether or not, for example, that's like, you know, being able to use a calculator, applying a calculator for math, let's say, or being able to, the way that photography, for example, changed the way that folks thought about art, right? In terms of really shifting and pushing towards like impressionist, post-impressionist movement, cubism, things like that, that no longer had to do with the realism of art, right? But rather like another quality of art then became available. Like, I think something like that could certainly happen with, for example, English writing essays. Like, you're no longer following just trying to teach the standard 5-paragraph essay to every single student, right? But you're trying to think of something. What's the more novel human thing that the AI can't do, that we can supplement the AI tool and embrace the AI tool as just part of the medium in the same way that photography is part of art, right? But it's not the only part. And still there's a human element to it essentially. And the goal is not just to make things as realistic as possible, because like photography is always going to make a more accurate, realistic photo, right? Than some people can, let's say, hand draw. But you know, there's still the human element required. And I think that's going to be true for quite some time, as far as trying to figure out what is that human element that we can bring out and complement the AI tool. The folks that are just trying to say like, oh, let's just ban it completely, right, is I think going down the wrong path in terms of trying to just resist this change that is going to be an important part of everyone's lives moving forward. And so I think resisting the change in the same way as trying to say like, you know, you'll never be able to, you shouldn't use computers at all, even, let's say, right?
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, a lot of these technological changes is a question of like how we integrate it, when we integrate it, how it becomes blended with, yeah, you know, existing, you know, practice. So that's where we're headed.
Yeah, and sort of in terms of getting there, I was wondering if, just harking back to your skepticism of the EdTech X stats, would you be able to outline the risks of overhyping Gen AI's current role and value in the education landscape?
I do think there's a degree of overhype, just because people are trying to predict the capabilities of AI. And this is not just in education, this is kind of across the industry, right? As far as people thinking, you know, as the progression, as we go from GPT-3 to 4 to 5, you know, 5 is going to start looking more and more like AGI. And this term AGI I actually really don't like, because I think it's such an ambiguous term. So I think it's a terrible term. I'm very much, I think like a camp of folks within AI, machine learning, that love AGI, and then a camp that I think just kind of like begrudges existence. For example, like Yang LeCun, I think he's still leading Facebook's AI team. He said before, even though Facebook, kind of their public position is to create AGI or make progress towards AGI, he said himself, like, I really don't agree with this term AGI, but like, this is not a hill I'll die on. Like, I'll say we're progressing towards AGI, but like, what does that actually mean? I think it's actually really, this really like nebulous term that is not useful for most people to discuss. And so I think the folks that are using it tend to be using it more as a marketing term than as like an applied AI, like a more meaningful term, essentially.
Want to kind of get into the, you know, very much to the point here, like the widespread use of Gen AI and how data-driven education has evolved as a result of that. You know, we've got Inside Higher Ed reporting that, you know, 50% of higher ed institutions are using, in the U.S. at least, are using predictive analytics to improve student retention and graduation rates. McKinsey did a survey that found that educators are using AI-powered tools to, you know, improve personalized learning experience. Holon IQ, you know, showed that 45% of educational institutions organizations use AI-driven analytics for optimizing resource allocation and staffing budgeting. So again, to the point of you know, AI taking up some of the admin space. So what do you see as the key trends that have shaped, you know, your company's direction as it, you know, partakes in this movement of generative AI dissemination there?
I'll talk about this from kind of industry and then from our perspective of what we're trying to do at Dewey. But I think the industry is looking at a broad range of their problems and trying to figure out, okay, is all these problems basically a nail for the AI hammer to solve, right? And I would say some of them have proven to be ones that are very quick and effective for AI to solve. So for example, with teacher tools and ways of saving time, essentially a lot of the ways that, you know, folks, not just in AI education, but widely are using ChatGPT, right? And so it can, that can be for kind of writing emails, or that can be something more specific like lesson plan generation. Now, I would say some of those things are starting to get some pushback or more scrutiny because, for example, if you tell ChatGPT, hey, I want a lesson plan about this topic that adheres to these standards, right? So standards are very important because every single state has their own set of standards as far that, you know, every lesson plan adheres to, essentially, right? With Common Core being a well-known one, for example, but not the only one. And so if you say like, okay, create a lesson plan based on the standards, ChatGPT will do it, right? Now, is it actually going to that be that standard? Maybe. But ChatGPT will definitely tell you it's going to be that, it is that standard, right? It's a, you know, and this is the hallucination problem that all Gen AI has. And so the, so how big of a problem is that? Well, it kind of depends, right? As far as like how badly it's hallucinating, it also depends on if an administrator is kind of watching, seeing the teacher teach something that they're saying what is one standard and but's another standard, right? Because obviously the student doesn't know. And a lot of times it's like maybe close enough, right? But if you're kind of blurring the boundaries now on something that should, I think in some cases, like legally be really sad, that's kind of a big problem, right? And so there's, I think, there's some more scrutiny, I think, that's happening as far as how AI tools are being applied, even though there's a lot of also, you know, enthusiasm as far as like what benefit they can. And so from our perspective, we don't necessarily view our platform as primarily a Gen AI platform, but rather as a data platform that uses Gen AI to make things easier, both from accessibility and interoperability. But it's like primarily a data problem that we're trying to solve rather than a Gen AI problem. And so that's really what we're trying to design is this AI operating system almost on top of a modern data stack. But it's still a lot of data issues that many districts, universities face that require traditional data engineering solution. So part of that is just being able to deal with large amounts of, you know, combination of structured, unstructured data, being able to solve data interoperability, being able to kind of produce customized reports and everything like that. And so that's been a problem for a long time. And the Gen AI is kind of one component of that to be able to solve, for example, being able to create a custom report much faster, much more easily, but there's still a bunch of kind of plumbing in the back end that you need to solve in order to get that to work, essentially. So the way we're seeing it is not just like, oh, we're taking Gen AI and applying it to data, but also trying to bring together a lot of these additional pieces of technology and apply it to the education space.
I think too, like that, I really appreciate that answer because, you know, I think to the point of overhyping Gen AI, there's like just been a lot of talk about like Gen AI for Gen AI's sake because it's like the new cool thing. And what you're doing is saying, hey, we use this tool, Gen AI, to improve your outcomes in the education space specific to K-12 and higher education. And just, you know, having browsed your website helps you do all these better things, like, you know, better processing of student information, better management of, you know, like classroom rosters and resource allocation, better learning outcomes for students. Like that, these are things you already care about. This is your job. This is your mission. And Gen AI is just, you know, a platform to help you do that better. So really appreciate that positioning that you're taking in the market. I think it's really smart and will hopefully help you land loads of great customers. So kudos for that.
And in terms of providing the architecture for educators to use AI responsibly, and as Paul said, in a sort of outcome-driven way, I would love to hear sort of feedback that you've received from educators who do use your platform.
Yeah, so I think it kind of falls broadly along two main domains. One is, hey, this used to take a week to do. Now it takes a few seconds to a couple minutes to do, essentially, right? It's like previously, like in order to pull together this data report, I had to go through all these different systems, download CSVs, collate them, you know, do some work within spreadsheets. And it would be, you know, 3-4 hours of work spread over a week, essentially to do. Now it's like, I just type in this natural language command into the platform. I get exactly what I want back, or like 90% of what I want back within like a few seconds, for example. So that's kind of one domain of feedback that we've gotten. Another domain is essentially, hey, I had no idea how to get this data. Essentially, it was something, you know, that I was always wondering about, let's say, or needed in for this particular point in time. And, you know, without this platform, I would not have been able to figure out how to access this data. And so those two use cases tend to be two different problem sets, right? One is kind of regular workflows or processes, let's say standard reporting that administrators want to see every single week, or a faculty might want to see every single week, right? The other is, hey, there's like a unique problem in this point of time, and we don't have anything set up because, you know, it's a unique situation. But we need data around it. And so how can we get that data quickly? Going to our platform allows a straightforward solution for that, right? And so that's much more kind of spikier usage as far as folks coming in and suddenly asking, you know, 20, 30 questions about something like really narrow and specific. Kind of the point of how we are building our platform, like I said, is more as an AI data scientist. So it's not just, hey, here's a report. It's, hey, what questions do you have about the report? What can we explain about the metrics? You know, let's kind of break down these metrics in a few different ways and explore them and be able to explain what we're doing as well, and to the level of, you know, kind of technical acuity scale to the user essentially as well. So it's a much more dynamic process, right? And that's kind of been, that was my experience as a data scientist in the past, is you give someone a report, they're never just like, oh, well, thank you, that's all I needed, right? They'll be like, well, what is that? Like, this chart looks funny, right? Like, what's the spike here on this chart mean? And so to be able to have a platform that's able to also look at that and answer with your follow-up questions is really powerful from that respect too.
Absolutely. And to sort of further illustrate that second usage case, could you give an example of sort of a unique problem that might arise that they can use your platform to solve?
Sure, yeah. So for example, one of the customers that we had early on was experiencing teacher strikes. And so being able to go in and say, okay, what, and this is the behavior that the teachers were exhibiting, both kind of pre and post strike, and to be able to monitor certain actions that the teachers should and should not have been doing. So for example, kind of going in and deleting courses so that their students could no longer access them, for example, and to also just being able to see like the impact on the students themselves, right? And to have that like granular timeline view of certain metrics in that way allowed them to kind of clearly identify, because of this event, these were both like some of the impacts as well as like some behaviors that they knew they were able to more quickly address, essentially. And so a lot of those reports, like they wouldn't need them normally to, or, you know, it wouldn't be kind of top of mind to review those type of things on a week to week basis. But in this particular instance, you know, there are a lot of specific metrics that made sense to kind of immediately review in this context too.
I have a fun one for you, Ben. I'm actually going to a talk later tonight by Sal Khan, the founder of of Khan Academy. I need to ask him a question. So what is one question you would put to Sal Khan of Khan Academy if you had him right in front of you and you were going to ask about his role?
I think the most interesting thing that's happening, or one of the most interesting things that's happening in Gen AI is this push for more personalized learning, mm-hmm. right? Which I would say Sal Khan and Khan Academy are at the forefront on with KhanMigo. KhanMigo is like an AI tutor persona that Khan Academy has released. And so a lot of districts, I believe, are piloting it, being able to use it as kind of personalized one-on-one tutoring, which has always been kind of a holy grail for in the past like 30 years for educators, right? It's like, how can you scale one-on-one tutoring more and more cost-effectively? And KhanMigo is supposedly a solution to this. But some of the things that has come up in and something that Sal Khan has talked about actually was how do you implement the right level of guardrails? Because it's essentially sitting on top of GPT-4, right? And GPT has its own guardrails, but those guardrails are not often sufficient enough for someone if you're like a 7-8 year old kid, for example. And there's ways to kind of go around the OpenAI guardrails as well. And so being able to, for example, ask KhanMigo to teach you how to like start up a meth lab. That was one of the things that I saw someone was able to get KhanMigo to explain to you, right? Mm-hmm. And so, wow. And then also that question or that point that I brought up earlier in terms of being able to adhere lesson plans to standards, for example, that like hallucination issue. I'd be really curious, like, as far as where they think their progress on that is going to, because I've also seen instances in which, and I don't mean to like pick on KhanMigo here because this is like a bigger issue than just KhanMigo, right? But I've also seen issues with that. So I think for any sort of AI personalized learning, the hallucination problem as well as the guardrail problem are going to be critical to be able to solve in the future. And so presumably Sal Khan either feels like they've solved it sufficiently enough or have a plan to solve it sufficiently enough to scale this well into the future.
Yeah, it strikes me that me and a buddy were actually kind of working on a bit of a tool for growth for men, for example, to advance their learning and development as in terms of like a positive masculinity context. But one thing that occurred to us and occurs to me with these ed tech products is like it can be a bit hard to build a moat around these products because of the openness and availability of platforms that you can build on. So very much to your question of like can't ChatGPT 4.0 do the same thing as what KhanMigo does is kind of an interesting one and I think extends to lots of other new products out there that are trying to build on top of these platforms.
Oh yeah, totally. So many of these platforms are currently in existence only because people I guess are either too unaware or too lazy to go to ChatGPT instead, but it's right. Essentially the same thing.
Yeah. Well, so interesting segue into talking about growth. Would love to hear a bit about, like, you're working in an incredibly, I think, competitive space to some extent. There's like 15,000 different school districts across the U.S. that you're looking to reach and loads of, thousands of higher education institutions. So would love to hear a bit about your growth strategy and particularly to, marketing, partnership initiatives that you're excited about. How are you looking to scale? You've got this new funding in hand. How are you looking to grow Dewey?
Basically, we have three channels in which we're making progress on. One is K-12, one's higher ed, just kind of selling directly to K-12 and higher ed, and third one's partnerships. And we're actually seeing the most traction on the partnership front, essentially. And so being able to work with kind of the larger edtech platforms, the ones that are generating a lot of data, and basically being able to say, hey, like we can offer you a better kind of white labeled or gray labeled analytics tool that you can offer your customers because, analytics is not, let's say, one of your core value propositions, but all of your customers, they want analytics as part of platform. And in a lot of ways, like this way of interacting with analytics is probably going to become table stakes within the next few years, right? And so there's a lot of like difficult data engineering around this, which is not just applying Gen AI as a wrapper around your data, let's say. And so being able to offer that as an expertise or as a component for third-party platforms, we've seen just a lot of need enthusiasm for that. And so that's been a great way for us to get into the market much more quickly.
In terms of that demand from those sort of like third party partners, how do you vet those companies that you collaborate with?
So basically at our stage, it has to be like kind of a certain amount of scale, right? So that's kind of number one. But additionally, on top of that, it has to make sense from like a data platform perspective, you know, in terms of, is this a platform in which it's, let's say, has a really basic or it's missing an analytics component and users are demanding more analytics around it. Typically, the edtech platform also needs to, let's say, have analytics somewhat on its roadmap, but doesn't necessarily, hasn't like invested heavily into it, because oftentimes, you know, it's much easier for us to come in and just like integrate with however analytics is being collected than trying to integrate with like an existing analytics platform, let's say, would be a more difficult integration, right? To say us, you know, you already have like some sort of custom dashboard that you want us to merge into versus us just being able to say, hey, here's something that's out of the box, very kind of turnkey solution that you can immediately offer your users, whether as part of existing analytics or as a new analytics tool from day one. And unfortunately, despite the need for education, is kind of multiple generations behind when it comes to their data stack, their application of data, right, compared to enterprise. And so that was definitely part of the hypothesis of trying to start doing in the first place. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of other companies apply Gen AI to data. Right. Very few specifically for education data, though. For example, Tableau, Looker, Power BI, they're all introducing a way to talk to your data. Right. There's a, you know, I can name half a dozen startups that are doing the same thing for enterprise. However, I think part of what we believe is that it's going to be really, really difficult to apply that to your specific enterprise without still that kind of like last mile hurdle of, hey, does the Gen AI doesn't actually know anything about my data specifically? And there's actually still a lot of things that I need to build out to create that semantic layer, that semantic kind of translation layer, so that it understands my data domain. So for example, like when I was at Snapchat, right, there's tens of thousands of tables across the company. There's thousands of custom metrics, right? Like, if I just apply ChatGPT or GPT models to Snapchat data, it would have a very low percentage of accuracy because it would not understand a lot of these esoteric custom metrics that Snapchat tracks, right? And that's just like for one specific enterprise. So you can't scale that to multiple enterprises. It's very, very difficult, right? So you still have to have a data team that's taking that natural language model that's sitting on top of your, whatever your BI tool is, and create like that connector between it and the understanding of your data. The reason that we're focused specifically on education is that we can build out essentially a education specific knowledge graph. And the idea is that every university, they might have some custom metrics, but it's more of it is going to look the same than different. And so we are kind of treating education essentially as like one big enterprise in which we're saying, if we only focus on education data and education data platforms, right, we only have to understand the data models of, you know, a few dozen of the major edtech platforms. And from there, we'll be able to create that semantic layer of understanding for 80% of the data that folks within education use.
How do you sync that with your earlier point of education needs look different in New York versus Texas versus Alaska? Like, you know, because the education happens within, you know, physical context for a lot of students, most students, all students, I guess. So yeah, how do you sync those two points?
So the difference here is that, you know, the district in New York versus the district in Kansas, like they have different needs, but they're both using PowerSchool, for example, right?
PowerSchool is
it's a student information system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's probably the largest market share when it comes to student information system, right? And typically, like student information system, learning management system, and then like assessment systems are kind of major sources of data for a district. And so they're both using the same underlying student information system, but their needs are different. And so we address the different needs by having the fact that the Gen AI is flexible to all those different inputs, but we are able to service both of those needs because the underlying data model is the same. And we have this, and it doesn't require a different understanding of the actual data model itself, right? Or maybe there's some slight differentiation, but typically, you know, people are not building huge, widely different variations of PowerSchool or these other edtech platforms.
I'd like to sort of just turn to your personal journey and sort of what differences you've experienced from working at sort of big companies like Google and Snapchat to now sort of leading your own smaller tech company.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as the differences, I mean, it's a huge difference, really, in terms of just time commitment and in terms of level of effort, right? In terms of stability of knowing what's going to happen in, you know, 1 month, much less like 6 months. And so I think there was a lot of great things to that experience, you know, being part of different companies within the Bay Area. But for the most part, it always felt fairly secure, essentially. You know, Snapchat wasn't gonna go out of business, or Google's not gonna go out of business, right? You know, overnight. And so not to say like Dewey is gonna go out of business anymore, like, or since we just raised, but to the idea, there's a much more just like underlying sense of anxiety that I have all the time as far as, are we going to succeed? How do we get to our next milestone of success, right? And everything like that. And so thinking in terms of in that framing has been very different. And also just thinking in terms of being able to build the company culture myself, right? Rather than just being a participant and entering into an existing culture, like, what is the culture that I want to shape for Dewey, and being able to set the vision for that? That's also been very, very different.
Yeah. And just as a follow on, like, what sort of culture do you want to build?
Yeah. So I think I think intrinsic motivation is really important. And especially for a startup. As a quick aside, the first startup I did actually was kind of 12 years ago, and it was a hot tub movie theater idea. So yeah, the idea was get a bunch of hot tubs, get giant screen, create a hot tub movie theater. It'd be fun. And ended up not doing it after like trying it for 6 months and then quitting. And quitting because after 6 months, I realized I didn't have this like intrinsic passion for hot tubs or movie theaters or anything related to that. And I realized how important that was, right? To have that passion for a startup, because that's like really what keeps you going during every single low moment, of which there will be lots of low moments, right? So how do you build that intrinsic motivation as part of the culture? One of the things that I felt when I was at a previous startup, while I was at Mux, is that oftentimes it felt like I was working with family, essentially, because like you see these people every single day. Oftentimes, if you're not working together, you're hanging out together. They become your friends, right? And it becomes this like really close, tight knit group, and it feels really good. And I realized like that was actually not quite accurate, because, you know, I have two sisters. If they stop being good sisters, like, they're still my family, right? They're still my sisters. But if you're no longer kind of performing well as part of the startup, then there's no longer a place for you, really. And so in that sense, it's more akin to like trying to build a sports team, right? In which, yeah, you want to get along with your teammates. You want to, you know, have personal relationships, let's say, and be like, and enjoy, you know, playing with them, essentially. However, you still have to kind of keep your eye on what the ultimate goal is, which is to win the championship, right? And so if everything is not aligned towards that ultimate goal, you're not going to win. And there's still kind of room or tolerance for anything that detracts from that ultimate goal. And it's not personal or anything like that too, right? But it's like, this is what we all signed up for. And so that's kind of like the culture that essentially I'm trying to create, is everyone's bought in to this ultimate goal. And yeah, we want to also support each other and, you know, enjoy working with each other, but you know, we can't take our eye off the ball as far as like what we are all here for.
Yeah. Appreciate that sort of reframe. I think some people like overuse the like we're a family, and like companies misuse it too. And it's like you don't invoice your family or fire your family if they're underperforming. Yeah. Like, come on. Like, so
exactly.
And I think the sports team one is so motivating. It's something we've embraced at Literal Humans as well. It's just like, look, you cheer each other on, you support each other, you have your different positions to play on the field, as it were, you know, and that's, and you want to build, you know, authentic, deep relationships within that context, but you know, there's a limit to it. And also different people have different experiences of family. So like using the family motif can be triggering for some people who've had bad family experiences and stuff. I'm sure people have had bad experiences on teams and stuff like that, of course, but it's a little bit looser and more flexible, I think. So cool. Well, appreciate, you know, all that you shared with us today on your journey to build Dewey. It's been a fantastic conversation with Ben Dodson, the co-founder and CEO of Dewey, talking about transforming data for educators with AI. Ben, where can folks find out more about Dewey on the interwebs?
Yeah, just go to our website. It's Dewey, DOOWII.io. And you know, all the information is there on our website.
Nice. We'll be sure to drop a link in the podcast episode description. And yeah, thanks everyone for listening in. Please leave a review if you enjoyed this episode. Help us share, subscribe, drop us a 5-star rating. Pretty please, so we can keep bringing on great guests like Ben Dodson here. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It was really fun.